reality is, the president's rhetoric has always conflicted with the president's agenda.
Oh, excuse me.
It stifles their vitality.
Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. That noise you just heard was me slurping my soup. I apologize. You can take the boy out of Northampton, but you can't take the Northampton out of the boy. This is not just any old soup, either. It's soup served as part of a banquet here on the first evening of CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, here in our nation's capital. I've been invited down here as a guest of Pro-English, a most excellent group of people trying to promote the revolutionary idea that the USA ought to have an official national language, and that that language should be English. Well, Pro-English had their event earlier today, and I had the honour of addressing a gratifyingly large crowd of interested CPACers. There had been rumours that this CPAC would be wrecked by screaming, howling mobs of humanitarian idealists. So I had changed into a hazmat suit for my own address. However, the apostles of brotherhood and fair play failed to appear. The conference has two more days to go, so perhaps we shall be blessed with their presence later. Okay, Representative Paul Ryan is giving a fine stemwinder speech up there on the platform, and I'd like to listen. For your amusement and instruction, I'll give over the rest of this week's Radio Derb to my own address at the Pro-English panel. The title of the panel discussion was The Failure of Multiculturalism: How the Pursuit of Diversity is Weakening the American Identity. I used this as an opportunity to present my standard argument for racial tolerance and social harmony based on honesty and realism, rather than on wishful thinking and moral posturing. Here you go. Mandy, could you give me a refill of this excellent Bordeaux, please? It may be sincere, thank you, my dear.
But I cannot imagine a vision of America more cynical than that.
Thank you, Peter. Our next speaker is John Derbyshire. He is a graduate of the University of College of London, where he studied mathematics. He is a contributing editor at National Review, where he's one of the most popular contributors. He lives in New York and is married with children. He is a prolific writer and the author of numerous books, including Prime Obsession, Bernard Riemann, and The Great Unsolved Problem in Mathematics. His other book is, among his other books, are We Are Doomed, Reclaiming Conservative Pessimism. The American Spectator wrote about it that there was, quote, not a better way to find happiness than to read this very gloomy and very funny book. Judge Robert Bork said, John Derbyshire contends that a comprehensive pessimism is the natural home for realistic conservatives, a breed that understands human nature better than utopian liberals and happy-talk conservatives. His argument is wide-ranging, erudite, and invigorating, but paradoxically delivered with cheerful panache. Ladies and gentlemen, our next speaker.
Thank you, Bob. I'm going to put to you what I think you will find a rather startling, perhaps absurd proposition. that the elite classes of the United States will turn racist. As startling as it may be, this is not an original idea. Charles Murray has been in the news recently. Peter just mentioned his new book, which is about the cognitive stratification of US society. The trend, now more than half a century old, for professional elites to separate off from working class Americans, developing different and diverging lifestyles and practicing, one of my favorite phrases, assortative mating. That's elites marrying elites. You know, doctors used to marry nurses and lawyers used to marry their secretaries. Now doctors marry doctors and lawyers marry lawyers. That's assortative mating. This new book of Murray's is a return to the theme of the bell curve, which Murray co-authored with the late Richard Herrnstein, and which was published in 1994, almost 20 years ago. I'm going to start off with a quote from that earlier book. This is from chapter 21 of The Bell Curve, in which Herrnstein and Murray are discussing possible consequences, long-term consequences, of this cognitive stratification. Perhaps the most startling of the possibilities they suggest is that, quote, racism will reemerge in a new and more virulent form. And here's the passage that follows that. The tension between what the white elite is supposed to think and what it is actually thinking about race will reach something close to a breaking point. This pessimistic prognosis must be contemplated. When the break comes, the result, as so often happens when cognitive dissonance is resolved, will be overreaction in the other direction. Instead of the candor and realism about race that is so urgently needed, the nation will be faced with racial divisiveness and hostility that is as great as or greater than America experienced before the civil rights movement. We realize how outlandish it must seem to predict that educated and influential Americans who have been so puritanical about racial conversation will openly revert to racism. We would not go so far as to say it is probable. It is, however, more than just possible. If it were to happen, all the scenarios for the custodial state would be more unpleasant, more vicious than anyone can now imagine. That's Herrnstein and Murray writing almost 20 years ago.
John, can I interrupt you real quick?
Yes.
And I'll let you get back. But
all right.
I just want to let people in the audience know that we have a special announcement, and so don't leave just yet, because Congressman Stephen King from Iowa is expected to be joining us in a few minutes. So you know, let's you might want to stay around for that. Thank you.
Sorry. That's okay. I should explain that by the phrase the custodial state, Herrnstein and Murray mean a sort of Indian reservation policy where the elites fence off the low IQ underclass. That our elites might turn racist does indeed sound outlandish. The reigning doctrine on race throughout the Western world today is the standard social science model, which is too much of a mouthful, and I'll just trim it down to the standard model in what follows. According to this doctrine, all observed group differences are the result of social forces. The standard model says that there is a conceivable, discoverable, attainable configuration of social forces in which all group differences would vanish, and that we ought to strive to shift our own society towards that configuration. Among our political and cultural elites, the standard model is universally accepted. Looking to the future, there are three possibilities. One of them, possibility one, is that our elites will continue to adhere to the standard model. The other two possibilities are implied in the extract I just read from Herrnstein and Murray. Possibility two, we may attain the candor and realism about race that is so urgently needed. Possibility three, our elites will revert to open racism. Let's take the three possibilities in turn. First, continued adherence to the standard model. Note that, if you take group differences in all their generality, the standard model is not preposterous. The social and economic underachievement of women in Muslim countries, for example, easily yields to a standard model analysis. You make some key changes in your laws and customs, and the man-woman gap disappears. In fact, in some social areas, it more than disappears. 57% of US college undergraduates today are female. In group differences of outcome between races, the standard model was likewise not preposterous 50 years ago. Here in the USA, non-white citizens labored under well-known legal and social disabilities. In what we were just beginning to call the Third World, non-white populations had been humiliated and subordinated by decades of colonialism. So, remove the disabilities, dismantle colonialism, and socioeconomic group differences would surely melt away. So the standard model, as applied to race, was not preposterous 50 years ago. I think it's fair to say that now, half a century on, it is well into the zone of preposterosity. Segregation and colonialism have long since been dismantled. Trillions of dollars have been spent to rectify past wrongs. Countless helping hand policies have been enacted. Yet still, the world and our individual nations are deeply stratified by race. The harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved. To quote the prophet Jeremiah, my favourite prophet. This is the cognitive dissonance that Herrnstein and Murray wrote about. Now, neurologists tell us that the brain abhors cognitive dissonance, just as nature abhors a vacuum, and that, as with a vacuum, the resolution can be sudden and dramatic. Our elites are snobs, but they're not fools. The dissonance between what all good folk are supposed to believe and the evidence of our lying eyes must sooner or later be resolved when enough little boys have called out that the emperor has no clothes. If you want to say that such dramatic turnarounds simply don't happen, I need only remind you that our elites, well within living memory, expressed opinions about race that would disqualify them from public office nowadays. And also about other things. Here's a quote. Quote, "To hold that the act of homosexual sodomy is somehow protected as a fundamental right would be to cast aside millennia of moral teaching." End quote. That was the Chief Justice of the US Supreme Court, the person I think can fairly be taken to belong to the elite. And the date was 1986. Bowers v. Hardwick. If you want to object that elite opinions are in line of descent from Marxist egalitarianism and that racial egalitarianism is of their essence, I will remind you that Marx, in common with well-nigh all thinkers on large social and economic matters until the middle of the 20th century, Marx was entirely Eurocentric. He had no interest in non-Europeans. His theory of the Asiatic mode of production is universally considered to be the least well thought out, most perfunctory part of his work. Plenty of Marxist-inspired movements have been racist. Back in the 1920s, when it was starting up, the South African Communist Party marched under banners reading, "Workers of the world unite, for a white South Africa. Today's China and North Korea are both officially Marxist, yet they are two of the most racially particularist states that have ever existed. China, in fact, offers us another reason to think that our elites will dump the Standard Model. In China, the Standard Model is not held in very high regard. When Taylor Wang went into orbit on the space shuttle in 1985, China's main television network marveled that he was, quote, the first descendant of the Yellow Emperor to travel in space. Now, even in the aggressively Anglo-Saxon America of 1961, it's hard to imagine Walter Cronkite hailing Alan Shepard as the first descendant of Alfred the Great to travel in space. The rise of a competitor superpower with frankly race-realist attitudes can only increase the cognitive dissonance that Herrnstein and Murray wrote about. For an accelerant, there will be the fact that an ever larger portion of our elites will themselves be descendants of the Yellow Emperor. Advances in the human sciences will be another accelerant. Sooner or later, a point of crisis will be reached. The spark will jump the gap, what has been stretched will break, the avalanche will slip, and the Standard Model will no longer be tenable, even for elites as preening in their moral vanity as ours. So much for possibility one, continued adherence to the Standard Model. It's not going to happen. Without the Standard Model, however, our elites will not necessarily take the dismal path predicted by Herrnstein and Murray. The path to, quote, racial divisiveness and hostility that is as great as or greater than America experienced before the Civil Rights Movement. What I call possibility three. There is also, as an alternative, the second path, what I called possibility two. A turn to the, quote, candor and realism about race that is urgently needed. This path is obviously to be preferred to the other, and it's the point of view for which I proselytize. It's also to be preferred to the Standard Model. The common perception is that the Standard Model is a humane and socially healthful point of view, while realism about race is the sick product of twisted minds. It seems to me that the opposite is the case. The Standard Model seems to me to be socially poisonous, a great generator of rancor, resentment, rage, and division, an evil and destructive doctrine. Imagine you are a member of a group that, in the generality, underachieves socially and economically. A black in the USA, an Inuit in Canada, a Pacific Islander in New Zealand, even a Malay in Malaysia. If the Standard Model is true, the only possible explanation for your group's underachievement is malice on the part of other groups. Hence the rancor, resentment, rage, and division. If, on the other hand, group underachievement is a consequence of the laws of biology working on human populations, there is no blame to assign. The fact of group inequalities, even in societies that have striven mightily to remove them, is as natural and inevitable as individual inequality, which nobody minds very much. The only proper object of blame is Mother Nature. And Mother Nature is capable of inflicting far worse things on us than mere statistical disparities between ancient inbred populations. Under a reigning philosophy of candor and realism, each of us can strive to be the best he can be, to play as best he can the hand he's been dealt, in liberty and equality under the law. I hope this will be the point of view our elites will arrive at when the Standard Model crumbles into dust. the other alternative, the one envisaged by Hernstein and Murray, would be worse, far worse. I intend to do all I can to promote the idea that there is a sane path, a path of reason, fairness, and liberty, of, to quote Hernstein and Murray again, candor and realism, a path between phony egalitarianism and vicious neo-racism. Follow me down that path, please. Thank you.
I believe that these approaches are...
There you have it, listeners, live from CPAC. We are still waiting for the legions of progressive social justice to show up with their pitchforks and Molotov cocktails. But it seems they have been delayed until tomorrow. As soon as we get back to our hotel room, I shall get the girls busy with filling sandbags and boiling up tubs of oil to tip out of our window onto the besieging hordes. Fortunately, we brought a good supply of oil with us on this trip and plenty of protective devices. So have no fear for us here in Washington, D.C., gentle listeners. We shall emerge unscathed from the coming fracas to bring you more live breaking news from Radio Derb next week.